Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Hegler, the Administrative Director here at the Court, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Supreme Court of Ohio. Before I introduce Chief Justice O'Connor, I'd like to give you a bit of background. Today's presentation marks the 12th consecutive celebration of Black History Month here at the Supreme Court. The tradition began in 2009 when we heard inspirational words from the late Honorable Robert Duncan, who served as a justice on this court and who also served with distinction as a federal judge here in Columbus. Judge Duncan was followed by 17 inspiring presenters who, in their words, described the contributions of African Americans to American history and the history of our state. Our presenter today, the 19th speaker, is the newest member of our court, Justice Melody J. Stewart. Welcome, Justice Stewart. I also want to welcome and acknowledge the justices of the court who are here today. Justice Sharon Kennedy, Justice Judith French, Justice Patrick Fisher, Justice Patrick DeWine, and Justice Michael Donnelly. We also have here in attendance a number of judges and other dignitaries from our courts and government. Welcome to all. Before we get started, I want to take just a minute to thank some members of the Supreme Court staff who put together this event. First, our Civic Education Manager, Sarah Stifler. Our Public Information Manager, Ann Yeager. The Public Information staff and their director, Ed Miller. And our Facility Services Coordinator, Chris Lozon. Thanks also to the staff of Ohio Government Television for live streaming our event today and for making it available in their online archives and for an upcoming broadcast on the Ohio Channel. Now I also want to offer my welcome to the students, teachers, and staff of schools in attendance today. Metro Early College High School, Columbus Downtown High School, and Westland High School. Now a couple quick reminders before we begin. I'd like everyone to please take a moment to shut off or to mute your cell phones. Also, a reminder that flash photography is prohibited in the courtroom. And now here's the important part. At the conclusion of Justice Stewart's remarks, please ask questions. And when you ask your question, you can either come to the microphone that's there in the center aisle, or you can raise your hand and one of our attendants will bring you a portable microphone. It's now my honor to introduce the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Ohio, Maureen O'Connor. Chief Justice O'Connor has served Ohio in public service since the 1980s. She served as a magistrate, a common pleas judge, a county prosecutor, Ohio's lieutenant governor, and the head of the State Department of Public Safety. She was elected to the Supreme Court as an associate justice in 2002. In 2010, she became the first woman in Ohio history elected as the Chief Justice, and she was re-elected to the position in 2016. Chief Justice O'Connor has been a champion for many issues, including legal aid for the poor and access to justice, reforming the system of fines, fees, and bail, which greatly affect those who are economically disadvantaged. Our Chief Justice has presided over an expansion of special courts that serve veterans, families, and others suffering from drug abuse and addiction. And she has taken great strides in advancing the use of technology in the courtrooms throughout our state. The list is long, but I'll close by saying that Chief Justice O'Connor is an innovator who's always looking for new and different ways to advance justice in our state. So it's my pleasure to introduce the leader of Ohio's judicial branch. Please join me in welcoming Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Director Hegler, for that introduction. Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here with us today in this beautiful courtroom in our beautiful building. We have the privilege of working here every day, and I want you to know that it's just as special to us after we've been here years and years every time we see it, because it is a one of a kind. I'm excited every February when we have Black History Month, and when this year is no exception. In fact, it might be even a little more special. It is such an honor for me to introduce another justice from our court, and not just any justice. She is our speaker this afternoon. As you probably know, Justice Melody Stewart is the first African-American woman to be elected to our court. And that's not all. Justice Stewart is an accomplished musician, hence the title, Music and the Law, which she will elucidate on us as we in a few minutes. In fact, she became a musical talent way before she became a talented lawyer, judge, and justice. Justice Stewart has done a lot of things in her career. She's worked in healthcare management, she's been a law school faculty member and an assistant law school dean, and she's held many other positions of achievement. She became a judge in 2006 when she was elected to the 8th District Court of Appeals in Cleveland, which is Cuyahoga County, and was reelected there twice. Then she was elected to the Supreme Court for a term that began last year. The foundation for all this hard work and accomplishment was music. I'm as excited as you are to hear her musical story and how she ties it to her work here in this courtroom. What I can tell you now is that Justice Stewart, a lifelong student of the piano, graduated with a bachelor's degree in music from the world-renowned Ohio institution known as the College Conservatory of Music at the University of Cincinnati. She earned her law degree as a Patricia Roberts Fellow at the Cleveland Marshall College of Law. And then she started on her legal journey, but kept music in her mind and at her fingertips. After all, her first name is Melody. On a personal note, I can tell you that Justice Stewart is a hardworking and innovative justice. I appreciate the work she does to prepare for oral arguments here in this courtroom and the long hours of careful thought she places behind her opinions. I admire her intellect and her points of view. You will note on the back of your programs that the 18 African-American speakers in this series so far have come from all walks of life. Their contributions are notable. Justice Stewart, as I mentioned, is the third African-American from this court to address Black History Month. Jeff mentioned Justice Duncan. Justice Yvette McGee Brown was appointed to the court as the first African-American woman to serve, and she also spoke in this room. Now we will hear from the first African-American woman to be placed here on this bench by the voters. The Harmony of Music and the Law is the title of her address, so it's my pleasure to introduce you to our Black History Month speaker for 2020, the Honorable Justice Melody J. Stewart.
Thank you, Chief. Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me? It is indeed an honor to be with you this afternoon. And as you heard the Chief say, I started studying music long before I started studying law. In fact, music was the only thing I wanted to study coming out of high school and going to college. I studied music and began playing an instrument before I even knew what a lawyer was or what lawyers did for a living. So certainly long before I became a judge or justice on this court. For the most part, I don't think people think much about the connections between law and music, unless there's a lawsuit going on. For instance, some of you may recall a few years ago there was some dispute with the song Blurred Lines that was written by the singer-songwriter Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams that sounded very similar to Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye, right? Who was a deceased R&B singer. And so Marvin Gaye's family thought it sounded enough alike that there was a lawsuit instituted. The judge agreed and awarded Marvin Gaye's family over $5 million because his song was not properly attributed to that pop hit. Now, I wondered then, and I don't know the answer, whether the trial court judge who decided that case had any musical background. Now, not that one is required, but I was just curious. So that's what we think about a lot when we think about music and the law. Another example might be familiar with you. Have you ever heard of an artist named Lizzo? All right, all the young people said yes, those over 30. So there's some dispute of one of her hit songs. Someone is alleged to have said a line in part of the music, and they were not properly attributed to that hit song. So they say, hey, you have to either give us credit for that song, or you have to pay us royalties. So that's by and large what people think about when they think about law. But for me, it's a lot different. For instance, I think that there are quite a few comparisons, and I'll do them broadly, and I'll do them generally. First of all, when we think about, we categorize law basically in two categories, civil and criminal law. Civil law dealing with people harming or wrongs against other people. If you don't hold up in your end of the contract, if you're in a store and you slip on a banana peel and you hurt yourself. So those sort of things where there is compensation involved. Criminal law is when someone does something illegal, and they're generally billed as crimes against the state, although they're oftentimes individual human victims or property damage, they are still crimes against the state or against the government. So for instance, if you committed a federal offense, it would be the United States versus, let's say, Mortimer Piccadilly, because it's brought in the name of the public, the name of the state. If you do commit a crime here in the state of Ohio, it would be the state of Ohio versus Mortimer Piccadilly. Or in the city of Columbus, it would be the city of Columbus. So when you commit a crime, you really do it to society, you do it to the public. Now some of you might be wondering who Mortimer Piccadilly is, right? It's just a name I made up that hopefully didn't sound like anybody here in the room. So, and with music, two general categories, instrumental and vocal. Vocal music can, of course, have music with it, or it could be without music, called a cappella. And so those things are pretty self-explanatory. Now let's look at how both are created. From the law perspective, we have statutes, two general categories, statutes, and we have what's called the common law. Statutory law is created by people we call legislators. That's our United States Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senators. Here in Ohio, we have the General Assembly down the street, our House of Representatives there, or our state representatives there, and our senators. And our local municipalities have council people. And they're the ones who draft the laws for the United States, for the state, and for your local governments. We call them legislators, and that's statutory law. And that is the main source of law for us. And then we have what we call common law. And that's what my colleagues and I do when we sit here on this bench. Common law are judicial decisions that have precedential value that all the courts in the state below us, the intermediate courts of appeals, and the trial courts must follow. So those are general guidelines, but they're give you a broad perspective, at least at how I look at things. When I was younger, and I'm gonna go past my introduction because I did that, there was a segment, I don't wanna call it a commercial, that came on Saturday mornings by an organization called Schoolhouse Rock. I hear a lot of mm-hmms, you remember that, right? And so it was instrumental in teaching me a whole lot of things. Now I'm gonna show video clips. Some of you, at least those of you over 35 or 40, will probably remember it, but it was helpful in my understanding of how statutory law is created.
Whew, you sure gotta climb a lot of steps to get to this Capitol building here in Washington. Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the Capitol City. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Gee, Bill, you certainly have a lot of patience and courage.
Well, I got this far. When I started, I wasn't even a bill. I was just an idea. Some folks back home decided they wanted a law passed, so they called their local congressman, and he said, "You're right, there ought to be a law." Then he sat down and wrote me out and introduced me to Congress, and I became a bill. And I'll remain a bill until they decide to make me a law. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I got as far as Capitol Hill. Well, now I'm stuck in committee, and I'll sit here and wait while a few key congressmen discuss and debate whether they should let me be a law. I hope and pray that they will, but today I am still just a bill.
Listen, of those congressmen arguing. Is all that discussion and debate about you?
Yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones. Most bills never even get this far. I hope they decide to report on me favorably, otherwise I may die.
Die?
Yeah, die in committee. Oh, but it looks like I'm going to live. Now I go to the House of Representatives and they vote on me.
If they vote yes, what happens?
Then I go to the Senate and the whole thing starts all over again.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And if they vote for me on Capitol Hill, well, then I'm off to the White House where I wait in a line with a lot of other bills for the president to sign. And if he signs me, then I'll be a law. How I hope and pray that he will. But today I am still just a bill.
You mean even if the whole Congress says you should be a law, the president can still say no?
Yes, that's called a veto. If the president vetoes me, I have to go back to Congress and they vote on me again, and by that time you're so old.
By that time, it's very unlikely that you become a law. It's not easy to become a law, is it?
No, but how I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
He signed your bill. Now you're a law.
Oh, yes.
I saw a lot of you singing out there, or at least mouthing the words. So I gotta tell you, after seeing that on a few Saturday morning cartoons, I fully understood the idea that someone has, and in that example, it was to put up a stop sign or something at a railroad crossing. That's a bill that you get passed in both chambers, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and then the president signs it. So by the time I got to social studies in school, I understood how that aspect of law was created. Now, again, I tell you, I still didn't know much about lawyering in law school, but I began when I studied music when I was about 6 or 7, and then went on through high school and studied. But by the time I got to college, taking courses like score reading and orchestration and analysis of sound and music gave me a skill set that fortunately translated well into school. Because of that, I figured it was my responsibility to likewise pass that down to generations of my family. And so that's one of the first examples of my attempt to get music education still. That's my youngest niece, Ryan. I could not get her to pay attention. And although she went on to take piano lessons later in life, and she played French horn in her high school marching band, she studied criminology in college. So law school might still be in her future, although she's doing a graduate program now. So that I think that tactile exposure and hearing the music and hearing what you can produce by hitting a key or strumming a string, I just felt was important. So not to be deterred, I'm down to the next generation. That is my great niece or my grandniece, where it depends on what you say. They're one and the same. So this is one of my nephew's daughters. Notice, I made sure she was a little older this time, so I could have more attention. And actually her dad, her father is a great keyboard and piano player. He studied music in Indiana and worked professionally as a music and a music director for a while. But now he's in healthcare management, so yeah, go figure. Now this little guy, this is my oldest nephew when he was a kid. My nephew Tony, who started playing violin. That's him at his fiddling group concert. Look at those feet. He's rocking those socks and sandals, isn't he? And interesting enough, as he got bigger, so did his fiddle. So then he studied the upright bass when he was in high school or junior high school. That's his high school graduation picture. And he played for his high school orchestra and the jazz band, and he played for a while with the Cleveland Orchestra Youth Symphony. And so he went on to college and studied double bass performance at the Manhattan School of Music and got his degree there. Guess what he does now? Musician, lawyer, those would be great guesses, but none of them are correct. He is a principal software engineer for a global marketing technology company in New York. Right? He did work for a while as a musician, and he did some other odd jobs, but he figured he had to make he had to invest in and look into a profession that was a little more lucrative. It had more lucrative opportunities for him. In other words, he needed to make more money to support his family in New York. But again, not to be deterred and continuing the tradition, he is passing down his love of music to his son. Notice he's on a step stool in order to reach that. And as I noticed my nephew's foot, he could use those socks and sandals again, or at least the socks part of it. And so why do I show you these pictures? Is it just to show you pictures of my family? No, it really isn't. It is to say how I think having a background in music can be a springboard to a whole lot of other things, not just law. So as my nephews did in technology and in healthcare management. So I think there are several things that you study that help you along the way. In earlier time, I said there's statutory law and there's common law. I think judicially created law, the decisions we write as judges, is more in line with music composition. That's because we have to take a set of facts at this court, two layers of courts have looked at them, and then we have to write an opinion. And what we do when we hear cases here, for those of you who have heard us or sat in on some of our hearings, we'll hear a case, and then my colleagues and I go into a room and we conference them and we talk about them, and then we vote, and the majority wins, whether it's a unanimous decision of 7-0 or whether it's a majority 6-1, 5-2, or 4-3. And then one of us is chosen with this high-tech method of choosing a writing judge to write the opinion on behalf of the court, which is called the majority opinion there. Now, there are nuggets in opinions, depending on what the case is about, that permeates the whole decision, and music has to be orderly also. There are a set of rules that are followed in order for people to understand them. One musical technique that has often been, to me, similar to building a judicial opinion is a music technique called a motive or a motif. And it's just a simple set of notes that permeates throughout a song. For instance, is anybody familiar with these four notes? Bum, 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 bum. Anybody? Everybody, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, specifically the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Let's listen. Thank you for that reminder. There are basically four notes. That's a four-note motive. Two notes are actually tonally the same, but in the rhythm. da 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 dum, and you see the whole first movement of that orchestra is built on those four notes. It's amazing. So although I think when statutes are written, there are certain rules of construction that need to be followed. And although we too have rules for establishing and setting forth our opinions, there still needs to be a flow, and it needs to center around an idea. Now, this next one, another example. Just listen for the simplicity of the notes that really become quite interesting based on the orchestration and whether notes are doubled or whether they're put into harmony. And this might be familiar to you, too. You might have heard it if you go to a movie and it's often used for dramatic effect. Or if you go to a sporting event, it's used to get your team pumped up and raring to go. So let's take a listen. That song is called O Fortuna. It's written by a composer in the early 1930s, Karl Orff, and it was based on a 13th century poem. But again, four notes, dun, 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 throughout the whole thing. And so in modern time, we call that a hook. But for musical technique, it's called a motif. Now, first of all, it just so happens these are all four-note motives, and they don't have to be four notes, but they can't be too long. And if you think that it's just a technique that's related way back to classical music, you'd be mistaken. See if you know this one. Familiar? That song is so much more interesting with lyrics, right? That is the entire song from beginning to end, those four notes. But when you have someone singing, that song is, of course, Yeah, by who? Usher, that's right. But the lyrics and the rapping of the beat, the extra instrumental, and then you're probably dancing, so you just really are kind of hearing the rhythm. But the whole hook are those four notes to that song. And it's so interesting, too, because we were rehearsing and doing, getting ready and checking the sound system for this. So our public information person, Ed, standing back there, see him in the middle there, he would get his groove on with that song. Don't let that suit and tie fool you, okay? All right, so now you've heard some examples. Let's do some visuals. That's our jaywalking statute for the state. Nobody jaywalks in here, right? No, nobody ever does that. So notice how, so we have what's called our code sections. So this is section 45.11.50 of the Ohio Revised Code, our state law, our statute for a state. So, and there you see this kind of a rhythm to it. The first three subsections start with where a sidewalk is provided. You know, you're supposed to use it. Where a sidewalk is not available, what you're supposed to do. And when neither a sidewalk or a shoulder is available. And so there's a natural order in how it's written. And then for D and E, we have some exceptions there. Littering. Nobody here does that, right? So this is one of our several littering statutes. And this one is quite long. As you see, to get on the screen, it's about 3.5 pages. And this statute is interesting because it tells you what you can't do, where you can't, what you can't throw out, but it doesn't tell you what the penalty is for doing it. So then we go to a penalty section. So sometimes when we're looking at laws, we have to refer to this for the action, refer to this for the penalty, refer to that for the exceptions. Very similar, at least for me, in composing music, there are times you have to know what the brass is doing, you have to know what the strings are doing, and so it's, but it all comes together to get your outcome. This is another littering offense. Why is this different? Notice the other one started with 37 something, and this one starts with 45.11. Which is a particular provision dealing with automobiles in our statute. So this is littering from a car, which boggles my mind that someone would roll down the window of the car and throw something out as opposed to keep it in the car until it got there. So this is just an example of state statutes. This is an example of one of the opinions we do here at our court, or at least in its infancy. This is a case we decided not too long ago that dealt with a dog bite. What responsibilities you have when you have a dangerous dog, or at least someone else thinks you have a dangerous dog. And so common law or judicially created law will always have a plaintiff or petitioner versus a defendant. Someone versus someone. This case is the state of Ohio versus Jones. Mr. Jones's dog bit someone and the city cited him for it. I happen to be chosen to write the majority opinion in that case, so you'll see that my name is at the bottom writing for the court, or at least the majority of the courts in this case, and then it goes on and it talks about the cases. Now, anytime when Chief Justice O'Connor has to author opinion, then she will have a CJ in O'Connor. My colleagues here will have a J in front of their name, J. Kennedy, J. French, J. Fisher, J. Dwine, and J. Donnelly. When I was in law school and first started reading opinions, I would look at Smith J., Marshall J., and I thought, wow, it's so ironic all these judges' first names start with J. It wasn't until after about the 25th case and I said, it must stand for judge or justice. At the Supreme Court level, stands for justice, and at the judge level, at the Court of Appeals, it stands for judge. But so just want to show you visuals of what our law looks like. One other mechanism that I think has been helpful for me in music has been the check of implicit biases or unconscious bias. Anyone know what that is? You all understand? We all have them. Every single solitary person in this room has some set of implicit biases. It's just who we are. It's a combination of how we're raised, where we come from, the environment we're in, what we see in the news media. you know, how much we take the time to learn. So we all have them. We have preconceived notions about things before we get to hear all the facts. And we as judges and justices try not to do that. We listen and read the facts first before we make up our minds or our decisions. But there's something I learn, I think, in school when studying music to learn to guard against. You can't do away with them completely, but at least it's something that you can help guard against. So let's do an exercise to see how you do. I want you to listen carefully. There won't be anything on the screen to start, but I want you to picture or envision any one person or more people participating. Envision what they look like, where they might be. Just try it. Did the band members look like you expected? No? Okay. That's a group called Lala's Big Live Band. And it's a group that educates children with music and on musical instruments. Maybe it was hard because you're not quite sure what that genre of music was. So maybe this one will be a little easier. Maybe, maybe not. Thank you. How about that one? yeah, and I wish I could play the cello like that. Does anyone know who that was? That was a young cellist named Sheku Kane Mason, and that was his big sister accompanying him on the piano, Isada Kane Mason. They are two of seven children, all of whom are musicians. One last one, okay? See how you do. I forgot to say, they were playing a beautiful piece called Elegy by the classical composer Sergei Rachmaninoff. Last one. This one might be me, huh? As you expected. So that was then 11-year-old Joey Alexander. Now, he was born and grew up in Indonesia, not a hotbed of jazz, right? But he used to listen to his father's albums, and he loved jazz, and he's become a very popular jazz artist. He was playing a tune called Monk's Dream by the great jazz pianist Thelonious Monk, which a lot of jazz piano players my age and older can't quite master like that. But this summer, Joey will be an old man of 17. So I just played those for you too to be sure that there is an appreciation for what you hear and what you read when you're reading, whether it's the law or anything that you read. Music is primarily, of course, for entertainment, and it's subjective whether you like it and whether you don't like it, but it also helps to do other things. There is music therapy, of course, used to alter moods, so music can be uplifting, and you can use it to calm your nerves, and it can be soothing, and so it's all those things. In addition to what I like to do in music when I have time, and in addition to traditional instruments that you know about, and many we've seen here today, a cello, a piano, a bass, I like to get my hands on some lesser-known instruments when I can. And so, does anyone know what this is? This is called a rain stick. All right? And no, I can't do this and make it rain. Hold up in the, but I can do this and make it sound like rain. Now you go, how is that an instrument? It's just a hollowed out piece of wood, you know, making noise. Actually, you can play it like that, or you can shake it. And sometimes I just do like this to see how long I could get the sequence going. Directions. But I gotta tell you, sometimes I do this, and let you in on a secret now, my colleagues don't even know this. Sometimes after reading a lot of cases that we have of different subject matters, or some pretty hefty subject matters, I will sit and do this for about 30 minutes, 45 minutes to an hour, to purge all the stuff out of my mind that I just read. And I just sometimes walk around the house doing it too. And so, any of you ever hear of a song that had this before? Yes, you have? All right. For those of you who shook their head, you shook your head, no. It's often used primarily for meditation pieces. So let me show you an example, or let you hear. Now, just like the laws, some of you may like that, and some of you may not like it, but it is still music, and the law is still the law. Now, remember this video with the rain stick played. So, in the brief period of time we've had today, I hope you're able to take away something from this. For the students, I have an optional homework assignment for you. Your teachers might find it, might not make it optional, might have you do it for bonus points or something. But our civic education manager will make sure your teacher has it, and she, and only she, other than myself, we'll know the answers to the question. It's just brief three questions. It'll involve a little bit of research, some connective thinking. And what you say do I get if I get it all right? Well, one, you'll get the satisfaction of knowing you got it right. And maybe there's some other bonus points or something involved in it. And so I thank you all for your time and attention today. Thank you.
Thanks, Justice Stewart. Now, we now have some time for some questions and answers. So, again, if you have a question, you can either raise your hand and someone from our staff will bring you the microphone, or you can come to the center aisle there and ask.
No questions.
There we go.
I'll call it the rhythm stick. I noticed on the screen that it was decorated. Mm-hmm. Does that make a difference in the sound when you have decorations on the stick?
That's an interesting question. She asked the one she saw with the band playing, Lala's Big Band. And actually, prior to that piece playing, she made that stick with some children. So the decorations on the outside don't matter. It's the circumference in the middle that matters. It's a hollowed out piece. And then there are nails that are pounded in to make the rocks or the pebbles go in different directions so that it trickles down easier. If it was strictly hollow, it would just pour down from one side to the other. So the outside decorations don't matter. And if you ever go online and look, there's a tremendous amount of them. Also, so the circumference and then the size matters in the tonality of them, but not how they look outside. I would imagine if you wrapped one, it might muffle the sound more if you wrapped it in cloth. Yep, yes, right there, a couple there.
So, question for Your Honor, Justice Stewart.
That's a lot of titles.
So, if I recall correctly, you play piano or played piano, correct?
Correct.
So I know that piano is primarily an instrument that plays the melody of pieces, but also occasionally does the bass line. Do you have a preference for either, and if so, when?
If I have a preference for
either playing the melody or the bass line of a piece.
Oh, well, of course in piano you play both. And when I started learning, I learned hands apart. And the right hand always came easier to me than the left hand. And maybe because I'm right-handed. But playing classically, in my opinion, I had to have a better right hand facilitation. But if I played jazz, I kind of had to have a better left-hand facilitation because, as you stated, oftentimes the left hand is playing the bass, particularly if you don't have an upright bass or an electric bass with you. So I don't really have a preference. My preference is that I get them both right. There's one behind you, yeah.
What attracted you to the law from your music career, and was it like a big shock to your family, or was it like, we were waiting for this?
I had a mother who was very supportive. When I went to college, I didn't want to study anything else but music, and that might sound crazy, and for those of you thinking right now, when I finish school, what am I going to study, what am I going to do? I never connected what I studied to employment. So I never thought when I started school, what am I going to do with a bachelor's of music degree in theory? But fortunately, my mother never questioned, what are you going to do with that kind of degree? She just said, go to school, do well. She did look at my report card when I first came home, and the grades were good, and she frowned. And I said, what's the matter? And she said, music theory, music history, 16th century counterpoint, band, chorus, score reading. Do you take any reading and writing courses? And I said, yes, I have to take French and Italian and German. And so they were never really surprised. My older sister happens to be a lawyer, or at least has a law degree. She hasn't practiced in quite some time. And so I would never had a path carved out for me of what I should and should not be or should and should not do. It's just always told to whatever you do, do it well.
As a musician, have you performed different recitals or public performances? Where and do you still perform?
I have, prior to probably getting on the bench, I would do things like I belong to a music fraternity, a professional music fraternity, and we have shows or programs every month, and we rotate performing. And so I've done that. I used to, coming right out of undergraduate school, accompany people, singers, other solo artists. I'd play for weddings. So I never completely relied on music as a way of living. I have not played publicly in quite some time. My colleague Justice Donnelly plays rock guitar, and he performs publicly quite often. And I always slip him a little note that says, keep your day job. And so I have threatened to play with him, and we have been requested to play together, but it's just a matter of time. I sometimes disappoint myself when I'm at home playing by myself, so it has to at least be at a level that's respectable for someone. So I haven't done that in years. One more question? Okay.
At what age did you decide that you want to do something in law?
I'm trying to find the questioner. Where's your hair? Oh, there you are. I'm sorry, what did you say?
At what age did you decide you want to do something in law?
When did I decide? After I finished undergraduate school, I promptly took my music degree and got a job in the healthcare area where I managed an office. And after a year, I was intellectually bored. I ran the office. It was running smoothly. You bill, you did whatever you needed to do. And the vice president of the company at the time, the vice president, was in law school. And he would come in, he would sit his books down, and I would peruse through them. And reading the cases just seemed interesting to me. So I actually applied to law school out of intellectual curiosity. And then I have to tell you, when I got there, I thought I would have my clock cleaned as a music major with all my other classmates who were pre-law majors and government majors and, you know, history majors. I thought they had such a leg up on me. Well, not so much, I found out after I got there. And so it was just the intellectual aspect of law that made it interesting to me. And I figured I could make a living as a lawyer somehow, some way. And that's what it's been. Some people take what they do as a passion. Like, I have friends who are professional musicians and singers and actors, and they have worked hard to make a living in that field. I don't know that I have the backbone to do that, because there's music the art and there's music the business. And so what I decided to do was be able to have another interest, which is law, and make a living there, and that way I can do music, what I love, whenever I want, as a hobby. All right? Is that it for us, Sarah? We have one more? Okay. I think this has to be the last one.
My question, do you feel, with yourself or with anyone else, you don't have to answer it personally, but do you believe that the decisions that our courts, our lawyers, our systems have made, are they creating harmony among the peoples? Do you believe we are doing that? The decisions being made by judges and courts and
are decisions being made by judges in court creating harmony in our society? I don't exactly know. And there would be some that say, you know, it's really, with all due respect, it's not our job to create harmony. We have to decide the case that's before us, and it really initially impacts the parties before us. At our level, it has a greater impact across the state. It's the law we are more concerned about for the state. And that's why we're always saying how important judges are. And in Ohio, your judges are elected. And so at the trial court level and at the appellate court level is really where you're going to feel more of an impact. And so although we're human beings, obviously, our profession is not a perfect one, like all other professions. And I think we do our best to reach the right decision and to explain how we got there, and based on the law and the analysis of the law, and so that there's nothing else that can be read between the lines. At least that's my take. I don't speak for the whole court, but I'm speaking for myself. Okay? All right, everyone. Thank you.